tuned for a powerfully pertinent rebroadcast of the Visionary Activist Show from July 15th, 2010, at the beginning of the Gulf Ecocide, a tour of the deep ocean that we may cultivate wonder, curiosity, enthusiasm. Here we go. Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So we convene our council, of course, and to say, to be ever more effective players on the team of creation, let us have detailed knowledge, and knowledge may it lead to respect, and may respect lead to reverence, and so on to ingenuity, and then to collaborative cahoots at this time of dire beauty. We know in the mythological world that when heroes survive the underworld journey, they become ingenious tricksters. You know, when Inanna returns from the underworld, then she becomes a cultural redeemer and sails to the island of the tyrant and steals back imagination and science and knowledge from the tyrants that have stolen it. And we go, okay, we're going to go for that theme. And so it is more than perfect that today we are welcoming David G. Gallo, oceanographer, pioneer in ocean exploration, deep ocean scientist from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, to guide us into the realm of the deep sea, for which he is an ambassador. On the TED site, where he has spoken often, and I first heard him at TEDx, he is one of the first oceanographers to use manned submarines and robots to map the ocean floor with unprecedented clarity and detail. So may we explore the dire beauty of the Gulf and the ocean and the whole realm of cataclysmic climate change. Welcome, David Gallo.
Thanks, Carolyn. Thanks.
So allegedly, as again, BP announces no oil flowing into Gulf right now, not a permanent solution, but, you know, what do you know about this?
Well, I think the news, at least what I see on the web and on television, is pretty encouraging, watching that there's nothing oozing or rushing out of the top of that blowout protector. You know, it's very funny because they've put the lid on, and now what they're doing is trying to make sure that it's not leaking someplace else besides at the top. So we're not quite there yet, but it looks very promising that they may have actually, for the time being, stemmed the rush of that venom in a way into the life of the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes, and there is we want to kind of invite your lucid self and knowledge, you know, into the realm of because there is so much. There is knowledge about, but there's also fear-mongering, too, and it's hard to tell the difference. There's a site, you know, that is about the caldera, that there's a methane gas lake underneath the oil, and this could lead to a volcanic eruption in the sea, and then tsunamis that would wipe out everything. And it was actually a credible person who guided me to this, but as I was checking out the links, going, No, wait a minute. No, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Is this, you know, boys' testosterone, you know, is it credible? At first it seemed plausible, and then as I explored the site more, it was also full of, you know, strange right-wing hate Obama. Then I go, okay.
Yeah, sure.
So what is your understanding of the volcanic tsunami sucking everything in and then destroying all life?
Yeah, okay, let's go from what we know. One, we know very little about the deep sea floor, okay? We've only explored about 4% of the real deep sea floor out there in the oceans. And the average depth of the ocean is about 2 miles. And so it's tough to get down there, and it's pitch black, incredible hostile place to be as a human being. And sure, on the floor of the Gulf of Mexico, you have not only oil, but you have tremendous deposits of these things called methane hydrates. That's a way of taking methane gas and actually freezing it into a solid, and it's trapped in the sediments. And if you poke it or you shake it, you can release an awful lot of it into the atmosphere in a very short period of time. Can you, from that, make a tsunami? It would be difficult. You know, it wouldn't be easy to do. So I don't think that's something. This methane is routinely released from the bottom of the sea. Could we have a volcanic eruption from the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico? Almost certainly not. I don't know of any big lava lakes in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. And you're absolutely right to point out that sometimes these theories, even though they have a bit of credibility, people start to whip them into almost a fanatical worry about what might happen. I'll tell you one more thing in my own impression. is that it's not the big things like that that get us. It's the little things. So yes. That person in New Orleans that is not using her air conditioning, that has changed the way she uses water, that is walking or driving a Prius, et cetera, those little things are what will get us out of this. It's the little steady changing of our way of life, our habits, that are going to make this a better planet. And it's the little things that we've done all along. You know, the trickle of pesticides and herbicides and caffeine and the flame retardants, the stuff that we think makes our life most advanced, the steady trickle of that to the sea is devastating.
Did you say the steady trickle of caffeine to the sea?
Yeah.
Really?
You saw a fish awake for days on it. You know, caffeine, pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
Herbicides, pesticides, nutrients. It makes these dead zones. And, you know, you don't end up with oil-soaked birds, and you don't end up with oil-coated beaches. But that steady, crystal-clear trickle of water carries with it death from us humans to the creatures of the sea. It's almost like we've waged a silent war on the ocean. Now, on top of that, you have this BP mess, which not only puts oil into the ocean, which is not the best thing, but we compound it by using these dispersants, which is venom. It's the best way I can look at it.
Right, and that's why on the Woods Hole website, which people may want to go to, which is www.whoi.edu/, but that's why I said backstage I was surprised to see that there were a couple of great articles, you know, listed about, you know, disruption of food chain everywhere, but then there was also two scientists testify before Congress that dispersants are not really a problem. Mm-hmm. So that's not that you're endorsing that, you're just reporting that.
Well, I'll point out, though, that one of them, one is not at Woods Hole, one, I forget where he is from, but the Woods Hole character, it was careful to say surface dispersants.
Uh-huh.
Surface. But what happened with the BP Deepwater Horizon is that we're putting things at depth in the ocean. We're into this world that we know nothing about. And that is a huge worry to almost all scientists that I know find this really appalling and are demanding explanation about who's calling the shots and saying that that's something we should be doing.
Because even today on NPR News, they were saying dispersants in seafood shouldn't really be a problem. No.
Okay. Sure.
And right after your presentation at TEDx was Dr. Susan Shaw, marine toxicologist, you know, who was really guiding us into that it breaks down lipid membranes, skin and organs, guides it into the nervous system,
yeah.
Respiratory,
yeah,
blood, liver, creates chemical pneumonia, drowns all the, and the ingredients released. You know, there was also something on a science show on NPR that said, oh, and go to our website for a list of ingredients. And we go, no, we know from Susan Shaw that a lot of the ingredients are simply listed as petroleum distillates, and they are trade secrets, so we don't, so there's that. You know, when I last week's guest was also from TEDx, Latasha Brown, doing just fantastic,
sure,
work with the people, and she said that, you know, she had seen and had firsthand and secondhand reports of fishermen throwing up blood.
I hear about that routinely, and recently some kids swimming in the water near, no oil on the beaches, but swimming in what they thought was relatively safe water in, I think it was Mississippi, and came out with chemical burns.
Oof, yes.
So,
right.
I hate to say it, but there's a song Michael Jackson called All I'm Really Saying Is They Don't Really Care About Us. Who makes these decisions? That's what, and Susan Shaw is a great spokesperson.
Yes, and she actually dove in, bless her heart, to the Gulf, along with Philippe Cousteau, who also, they dove into this murk. And there's so much in what you say. Just to go back to, let us compost the non-useful fear-mongering, because there's plenty to be about,
sure,
without going.
Yeah.
Our great ally, environmental lawyer Carolyn Raffensperger, said, the tale of Jonah and the whale is interesting because, you know, Jonah gets eaten by the whale and then, you know, spit up, and he has a message from God. He prophesies doom to the people of Nineveh and says, you must repent, you know, and so, mm-hmm, they do.
And then Jonah goes off and sulks that the catastrophe didn't happen. So, you know, we don't want, because there are a lot of sulky prophets out there who are kind of rooting for the whole thing to go down. Going, it's bad enough as it is.
It doesn't, you're exactly right. There's that issue. There's the other issue that now not only do we have oil in the water, we have money in the water, and that brings out the worst in humanity, that I might be able to make a buck off this thing.
Which way? I mean, yes, but which way are you thinking?
Well, every way. I mean, I think people flocking to the Gulf because they just see ways to use this incident to further their own cause or make the most of it and take advantage of the disaster. And I hate that. Lawyers for one. You know, I mean, I know if they got lawyers, we need lawyers. I get that idea. But letting lawyers shape the argument and control the flow of information, I don't know where that fits into the rhythms of nature.
Aren't we pretty happy that Kevin Costner and his brother are there with their ingenious machine, apparently?
Well, they're doing okay. Yeah, I hear good things about Kevin Costner.
No, I never liked his acting, but he goes up a whole lot, you know, on this one, going, okay, for 20 years he's been working on this thing with his brother, you know, and funding it, and, you know, it does. So, you know, when you say the little things, and we go, because so many allies, you know, scientists, Ricky Ott, and people who've come alive since the Exxon Valdez, who've also been guests on this show, you know, they say all oil is spilled, as the point you were making, the little trickles of steady poison and pesticide and nutrients, and that oil cleanup, no, not so much. You can't really do that. And then some scientists saying, well, the ocean will be fine in a million years. I mean, what is your understanding of this mystery of the deep, deep ocean? Let's let you guide us to the deep, deep ocean. Its recovery capacity. I mean, I know we don't even know the extent of harm right now.
In my opinion, the ocean will be fine. It will be forever different. That's on us. You know, and if we're okay with that, we can continue along the path we're going. The Earth has been changing for 5 billion years, and it changes on its own. It's got its own rhythms, but we break it down thanks to scientific disciplines. We have plate tectonics, that means the face of the Earth is changing, and we have climate change, which means the climate of the Earth is changing, and it's just like a heartbeat. It's a wonderful thing. So we come along in our own way, a part of nature, of course, part of that rhythm, and then we start to fiddle with the symphony of nature to the point where we're adding cymbal clashes and the roll of timpani where it doesn't belong. Those are the oil spills and whatnot that we cause. So, you know, it does change it. The ocean will heal itself. The Earth will be fine without us. Is that what we want, you know, on our watch? Do you want it? We will make life miserable for animals like us and for ourselves and for the generations beyond us. And more importantly, I always think if you watch us from the moon, how we behave, having the ability with our technology to see into the future, we can see the infinitesimal, the edge of the universe. We can see the infinite by looking into atoms. We can speed things up. I mean, you can watch continents collide and mountains grow. You can stop a lightning bolt in its path or a raindrop and walk around it. Despite all of that technology and all of that wisdom that it gives us through observation, we act like idiots. You know, we just don't get it yet. And that really makes me nuts. So the Earth will go on its course. We'll come and go like the specks that we are. And hopefully, you know, we should appreciate this wonderful moment in time that we have as a species and enjoy this planet and enjoy this view of the universe we have. It's a remarkable thing. You know, every time we walk outside on a starry night, we should be awestruck at what we see. We should be awestruck at what we see.
And even especially tonight, actually, there's a right after sunset, there's a beautiful moon. To the left is Venus and then Mars and Saturn all lined up beautifully. Again, awestruck, the incredible order that suffuses creation, of which we are really meant to be. We love Janine Benyus, who says, why don't we quit looting nature and borrow her recipes? Again, for cooperation, this order that suffuses, why don't we know about it? Again, that's part of your guiding job. you know, and then what is the most respectful way to align and cooperate with it? Yeah, it is a huge opportunity now. I mean, it is a huge necessity. I think, you know, for the likes of yourself to be able so that we can, you know, animate and magnetize the collective story about now and the dire, and then the opportunity to really do fundamental change. You were mentioning, you know, again backstage, you know, that you were on this show, a PBS show, Need to Know, and was it your friend who said, when's the last time Americans did the right thing because it was the right thing?
Yeah, John Meacham, the host.
Oh, okay, John Meacham, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he asked when's the last time Americans did the right thing, changed their way because it was the right thing to do, excluding war. Not that war is ever the right thing to do. But I understood his idea is when did we faced with something that we said, boy, we need to change because that's the right thing. I can't remember a time. It's not just on America. I don't think. Was there a time, any place on the planet where people changed their way because it was the right thing to do? I don't know.
Well, it's a good wondering, and I think, you know, part of the I want to introduce back into public discourse the word sacrilege. You know, not to be, you know, right wing, but just to include the larger conversation, because it does mean, you know, its dictionary definition means the robbing of a sacred place, the crime of appropriating the sacred for the secular. And I go, uh-huh. Hey, I mean, doesn't that really fit the Gulf crisis?
Yeah, sure it does. And think beyond that. You know, it wasn't long ago that we were testing nuclear weapons in the sea, and that we were dumping all sorts of munitions and mustard gas in the sea.
Yes.
It wasn't that long ago. And those were the obvious things. And now we have all these things that aren't so obvious, that are subtle, that maybe even will have a longer-term impact on the ocean. But yeah, sure. Like, again, if you watch this from the moon, the thing that we seem to do best on this planet is to blow ourselves up, blow each other up. I mean, that's kind of what we do on this planet. And it's really sad. You know, you would hope that from somewhere on this planet will emerge a leader that will enlighten the this species of ours to looking at this world in a different way. You would hope that that would happen. I think people have come close, but I hope that leader emerges. Now, why not now? You know, this is, you know, we are a generation, my generation at least, that has had this wonderful new power of communication. And we have this at the same time we're faced with these. We are facing some huge environmental hurdles ahead, where it's going to be us and nature, and hopefully we learn to work with nature so we come out of it the better, not the worse. So what better time than now for us to make a stand and change, start enlightening people about how we should be living on this earth?
Yeah, and so as a sidebar, let's compost another really bad idea that was some people said it was credible. I had a guest on the show several weeks back who was, you know, sane in some ways, but he said, no, we've really got to use a nuclear weapon to seal the breach at the bottom of the sea. It's the only thing to do with the Gulf, because otherwise we're going to have, you know, 15 million economic refugees, and the Russians have done this before. And right. I go, wait a minute, no. And he goes, no, you've got to be a grown up about this. We just got to blow this thing up.
You blow it up. Exactly.
Right. Exactly. And I was, again, suspicious, like the caldera thing, going, wait a minute, this is more kind of boys blowing things up, you know, oh boy, we get to do this.
We love that.
Apparently the Russians have used nuclear weapons to seal mines, but never in the ocean. So,
tactical nuclear weapons, they put it down there, blow. Yeah, it's not easy, really, to keep up. You know, it's funny, all of this stuff is emanating from a hole that's a little more than a foot across. And that, isn't it amazing? We can drive a robot around the surface of Mars, and we can't plug a leak in our own backyard at the bottom of the ocean. It's pretty amazing to me. But the Russians have done it with nuclear explosions by disrupting that the flow of
right. But can we lay that to rest forever? Can you help us just put that to, like, no, we're not going to do that?
Yeah, I don't. Boy, I mean, that's some serious stuff. You know, this whole thing. And again, I have to tell you that we do not know what the long term impact will be deep in the Gulf of Mexico. That now that we have added dispersants, that, you know, if the oil was just allowed to come to the surface, we could deal with it then. We know how to skim that stuff off. We're pretty good at that. Now with dispersants at depth, it's floating in the water column, some of it at the bottom, some of it in midwater, and it's not a big blue fishbowl. That water's circulating around, and so there's little eddies and corners and nooks and crannies, and that stuff could be coming up for decades. You know, we just don't know. Still today, in fact, I think that we, the public, and some of the scientists I know, we don't know yet what's coming out, the chemical composition out of the seafloor. We don't know how much actually came out. We don't know really where it went in the deep ocean, and we don't know where it's going. And so when I look at that, you have to wonder, you know, what exactly, you know, President Obama, and I do believe he meant this, I said this at the TEDx oil conference, he said, we will attack this spill with everything we've got for as long as it takes. Now, at the surface, I believe that that's a true statement. You know, the Admiral Allen knows about the surface. He's got the tools there that he knows how to collect oil from the surface. But at depth, You know, I don't know what army we're attacking this with, but some of the greatest ocean champions I know are sitting on the sidelines. And
like who would you want to invite in now?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the most creative and accomplished ocean engineers, I'll say two of them, because one is well known, that I know and with respect across the board, James Cameron, the filmmaker.
Yes.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah. Because you've worked with
someone that comes close with his creativity and knowledge of the deep sea.
What an interesting idea. And what an interesting idea.
Oh, he's great. Well, we have had a meeting. We had a meeting. He called together 20-some-odd people from various quarters of the globe, various compass points on the globe, and we met for 14 hours in Washington, D.C., and it was a very good meeting. But there's one, for instance.
But I just want to pause because there the plot thickens. When you say, you know, could we not have a leader, well, I don't think we're going to have one of anything, one solution to anything. We're going to use many. You know, we don't want one leader. And one of the models, I think, is that, you know, I think the only thing that really distinguishes humans as a responsibility is our capacity to borrow from nature, including models of leadership, you know, from nature. That it's a conversation that we've been having on the air, you know, about wolves and geese have really great models of leadership. But when you bring in James Cameron, you go, the plot thickens because, you know, if we could animate, again, grab the collective imagination as the movie Avatar did, which was 3/5 a great movie, you know, and then it had, you know, blow things up. But it was almost great. It was almost great. If we could animate, you know, the imagination of people going, we have this larger calling, then we begin to be able to kind of co-create a magnetic story and mythos. Anyway, I'm just going, oh, okay, that would be good. And the other oceanographer that you admire, that you want?
Oh, there are many. I mean, there is Graham Hawks, who build some of the most creative underwater technologies. I've been in roomfuls with them, and all I'm coming at, and then, you know, there are not many people that know about this deep ocean world.
Right.
But the idea that notion that with all we've got, I don't know about that. And I don't think President Obama knows about it because it's been such a fragmented, the deep ocean community is just not a well-known group of people, you know.
So if we just synchronicity abounding, you know, I mean, there are people in the administration who listen to this show. We would like him to have a conference with the likes of you, James Cameron, Graham Hawks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that was the you know, it's one thing to you know, you have the engineers that look at this stuff and they really they have the ability to come up with the kinds of tools you need for the deep, and those are very few and far between. There aren't that many robots or submarines that can go that deep, and the human body can't go 2 miles into the ocean without technology. There's a scientist that asks the questions, and those are good questions because we need answers, and that's the scientist's job to do that. But then there's the communication piece, and you know, the likes of James Cameron that can tell a story. There's Melanie Marks of Shark Trust Wine. You know, that at that Cameron meeting, in the middle of all these engineers, got up and said, you know, if we don't take these answers to the people, if we don't tell the people what's going on, this is all for naught. That we become just like the rest of the meetings that are going on where the public doesn't know what happens inside these meetings. So I agree with you completely that we need to move this out of the realm of just scientific debate and engineering stuff and get it out into the world at large.
And
I think, you know, I do believe we can understand this stuff.
Yes, and I think, you know, one of the great medicines that Obama had during the campaign, his speech on race, for instance, was he was not infantilizing the American people. He was saying, we got to have a grown-up conversation. You know, so mm-hmm. we go part of that medicine and not infantilizing, like, oh, they couldn't handle it. Oh, no. It's like, no, you know, massive amounts of information and story and informedness and not hiding and transparency is great. And you yourself have been in manned submarines and, you know, and worked with robots to map the ocean floor. So how far have you been down?
Oh, 3 miles or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I have to tell you, you can't do that without it changing you. You can't go to the bottom of the ocean, descend. It's a 2.5-hour trip from the surface that we know, that lovely color Jacques Cousteau blue, up at the surface, and then slowly you drift down. It's very interesting what it does to your spirit. You slowly drift down through deep blue, dark blue, and then pitch black for 2.5 hours. And then you land, and on the way down, you're treated looking out the porthole of the submarine to this incredibly mystical world of animals that they're gossamer shapes, and they light up and twinkle at you, and it's an indescribable thing that just, it does, it just penetrates into your very being. And then you get to the bottom, the face of the deep. You land there on this landscape of shining volcanic mountains and hot vents where the temperature is 700 degrees Fahrenheit, and you find these oasis of life bursting with color, and you know, it's just such an unbelievable experience. Almost everybody that gets in the sub for the first time comes back and says the same thing, that it just changes your life forever and the way you look at this planet forever.
So, you know, I again mentioned backstage that one of ocean colleagues said that part of the beauty of the bottom of the sea, that I hope you'll guide us to more, the incredible corals and richness, and part of the life cycle, of course, is that all the little hatchlings, you know, go from the bottom all the way up to the surface and back down. And so he said, well, that then these corals are dead.
That's right. Well, a lot of them are, and we don't know in the Gulf. That was one of the studies that were underway. Because we know so little, we don't have the baseline that we need about what was living there. We know some places. There's a beautiful place, if your listeners go online and look up Flower Garden Banks. Flower Garden Banks, you'll see some amazing stuff, some amazing creatures. And you're right, too, about the importance of the deep oceans. You know, when we looked at corals at shallow water on, say, seamounts, these underwater volcanoes, you see the coral reef up on top. But then what we didn't know, we're just finding out about these, is that as you go down, you enter into a twilight zone and then a deep dark zone, so that all the way down that mountain that may be 2 miles tall, you find different ecosystems that are living in different levels along those mountains. So each one of them is just an amazing island of life. And we don't know in the Gulf how much damage was caused yet, because we don't have the handle on what was there beforehand. But boy, is it important. You know, the recruitment of larvae and things like that from the deep ocean into the shallow waters, not just for the Gulf, but for the whole Atlantic Ocean, is hugely important. And so it's going to take some time to know how much damage was done, and I don't know if we're ever going to really know how much damage was done, but my guess is it's pretty significant. And one of the things that we used to think was bad, and still bad, is this bottom trawling, for that very reason, that we would drag fishing nets and actually scrape the life off the bottom of the sea. Well, it's just not good. You know, it does a long-term damage to the ecosystem of the seafloor.
We're going to take a very short break in moments. Our guest today is David G. Gallo, deep ocean scientist from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, guiding us into the realm of the deep sea and more beauty and direness combined, you know, after break. The Woods Hole website is WHOI.edu/, and we will be right back after a very short break. Your children. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. That was Priestess Miriam, bless her heart, from New Orleans, singing to Mama Wattas, "The oceans are the mother of all life." Today, we're back with David Gallo, deep ocean scientist, and you were just now guiding us into the lakes, the deep ocean, more life than rainforest, life force, hydrothermal vents. I love the term extremophiles, which was the discovery of life out of these hot vents. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, well, I've got news for us. We dove. There's an underwater mountain range that wraps around the earth like the seams of a baseball, 50,000 miles long. And on top of that mountain range, as you get to the crest of it, there's a huge valley that goes right down the middle, and the valley might be 2 miles deep. And at the bottom of that valley, it's a lost world. There's constant volcanic eruptions, constant earthquakes, and these hot vents, which are geysers under the water, but the temperature extremely hot. And for all the right reasons, we said there shouldn't be any life there at all, because of the temperature, because of the lack of sunlight, because of the incredible pressure that would crush the ship like the Titanic, the same way you could crush an empty paper cup in your hand. And there were geologists in that valley, in those valleys, looking for volcanic rocks, and they stumbled across these incredible communities of life, hundreds of new species, living not off the sunlight, but living off the chemicals coming off the hot vents, which to us would be toxic. The way that it works is that there's a microbe that loves to eat that toxic stuff, and the microbe then lives in the organs of some of these animals, and the animals actually eat the microbes too, so it's chemosynthesis, not photosynthesis.
Huh.
The exciting thing about that is that the deeper we look, you know, these oases almost spring out of the deep earth as these volcanic eruptions happen. Shortly after a volcanic eruption, out comes these oases of life. Is that the deeper we looked, we started finding more and more microbes. And we started saying, well, how do they all get down there so deep in the earth? And now we're saying, oh, wait a minute. Maybe they didn't get down there. Maybe they're coming from there. So maybe we're looking at biogenesis, a form of biogenesis, every day on this planet, that it didn't stop 3 billion years ago or 4 billion years ago. It's been going on all along the top of that mountain range. It's a ribbon of life that wraps around the world. So it's kind of neat that we're seeing biogenesis happening today on this planet.
And just define more fully biogenesis.
Well, in this case, you're taking lava from the deep earth that we would normally think it just comes out as a volcanic eruption and turns into rock. But as a byproduct of that, or maybe a side or additional product of that, we think that some people do, and I think the evidence is growing, that you also start to get the building blocks of life. You know, you need three. I always think about life, and you need three things. You need the cookie dough of life, which is all the different amino acids and all that stuff. It turns out that's everywhere. We always act like it's very rare, but we all come from that one supernova that was 5 billion years ago or whatever, 10 billion years, something like that. You need an energy source that we assumed had to be the sun, and you need water. And in the ocean, the deep ocean, we have the cookie dough, we have the water, and we thought we didn't have the energy source, but now we realize that the planet itself could be that energy source. And all along the top of that mountain range, you have this constant incubator of life that's constantly mixing all these lovely chemicals deep inside the earth, and out comes the volcanic eruption, and also out comes what looks like a snowfall from the deep earth of these biologic bits. And when you look at them in detail, you start to realize that, boy, these might be the very first forms of life on Earth. So that if you wiped out all life on Earth, that it would regenerate itself from deep inside.
So this is important, late-breaking ancient news.
I think, it's been cooking, it's been incubating for some time, but I think the community that supports it is, you know, you can't help what you see. Yogi Berra, the great baseball player, said you can observe a lot just by watching, and he was right. When we stop and look, you see, it's for your audience, here's what happens. You get a volcanic eruption, and you have nothing but glassy volcanic rock on the seafloor for as far as you can see, a fresh volcanic eruption. Then you have cracks that open in that volcanic eruption, and from those cracks come these snowfalls. Again, like it almost is. We call them snowblowers because you have a snowfall that lands over football field size areas, maybe a couple inches deep. And when we look in detail at that stuff, we realize that a good portion of it's biologic. And so, and again, we used to say, how did it get down there? And now we're saying, oh, wait, it didn't get down there. It's coming from there. You know, we're looking at biogenesis. So, yeah, I think it's important not to offend anyone that has other beliefs about how life began or got to this planet. But it's a wonderful way, in my mind, to keep this planet alive. I love it.
And from within. Yes, no. And it's a wonderful image you're animating for all of us that can, you know, replace the everybody watching the BP, but you know, that particular snowblower of the. It's not that the oil is bad. It's where it is. It's like I love a friend of mine saying, it's not men I have a problem, it's what I do with them. You know, it's not emotions or feeling or science or oil that we have a problem with, it's what we do with it. You know, and
You got it exactly.
No, it's what we do with it. So, you know, bless that oil, you know, and go back into your home. But you won't, because we've dispersed you and we don't know what the effect is on the deep column, as you're saying. But to kind of feed on what were the wonderful buffet of knowledge and metaphor you're bestowing upon us. But if we say, you know, yes, may there be a leader, well, may that leader be nature. I mean, I think that the only truly completely trustworthy teacher is nature. I mean, there are humans who have, you know, we like the Dalai Lama and all, you know, but the only completely trustworthy, you know, is nature. So
sure.
I mentioned that I think humans can borrow recipes of leadership, which is really on our work table, because we do have ingenuity and we do have reverence, we do have knowledge, and we just need to apply it now and also animate the collective with the power of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I love the wolf model is from years ago, a wolf expert and my own living with a wolf, bless his heart, is that wolves don't operate on dominance, they operate on charisma, meaning their primary value is who elicits the ingenuity from the group. They go, that's what we want. And then, of course, goose, you know, lead goose always rotates, because any leader out front takes the flak and will be destroyed by the wind, the air, or the culture. So I like this idea of rotating and wolves. But to bring it back to your domain, you know, you guide us into this deep place where they're at the bottom of the ocean floor, where there's, you know, waterfalls, you said, and lakes,
yeah,
and rivers, and
sure,
this incredible blowing of life. So what do you think, or maybe just start us to wonder, you know, what qualities of knowledge or leadership could we derive from this deep, deep realm to which you are dedicated?
Well, you know, I really do think that the way we educate people, the disciplines of science, is probably the wrong way to go. I just see it as an effort to knock all the rough edges off people and to beat out of this very natural understanding of the rhythms of the universe, of life and everything else. You know, we don't teach it that way. We don't want the symphony. We want to focus on just the cello, and in a horrible way. You know, the things we test, if you wanted to hear music, instead of playing the cello, we would say, okay, let's test the tension. Tell me what the tension is in each individual string, the flexural rigidity of the bow, of the wood, the chemical makeup. Those are the things we test, and it has nothing to, you could get 100 on that test and be one of the worst cello players on earth. And I think we do that with the way we teach, is that we don't teach the big picture, the big story, that there are these rhythms and cycles, one on top of another, that there's a symphony of cycles. So I think from the deep sea, there we find one of the most incredible records of Earth history, in the rocks of the deep sea, in the sediments of the deep sea, the corals, the ice caps, that bringing that out and letting people see those rhythms, I think would start us to understand that this planet is alive and that nature does have a course, and that it is in our own best interest to work with nature and not fight against it. So I think nature, especially in the ocean, can lead you. I mean, we are drawn to the sea, as you point out. I mean, we, the rhythms, the sound, the smell, it calls to us, and we're so much a part of it, our makeup of our blood, you know, all that stuff. But it is from whence we came. And also, the bit about extremophiles. Really, we've become the extremophiles. If life began, or a good portion of primitive life began in the ocean, we're the knuckleheads that decided to climb out, where we have rocks dropping on our heads occasionally and weather patterns that we can't control. So we really are the ones out here living on the edge of extinction all the time, not those animals at the bottom of the sea. So I think the ocean, if we could give it a voice, again, as my friend Melanie Mark says, we need to give the ocean a voice.
Yes.
Let the ocean speak to us. And we will learn from that. So I believe what you say 100%.
And yes, we've become the extremophiles, and yes, so much. You are a great scientist poet. You have wed these things wonderfully, and we want you to be able to be a voice louder, you know, more and more opportunities. Because yes, how we teach, you know, this crucial moment, okay, dire cataclysm, we want to know and we want to be able to grieve. And so we have been so rude here and in myriad ways, as you point out, with the slow and, well, pretty actually fast poisoning, but comparatively to the Gulf cataclysm and
sure. And
sacrilege. But that's why also backstage I said, have you ever killed a giant octopus? And you were like, no. Because
no, why would I?
Well, exactly. No. But again, how we teach and how we learn and how we think of as, you know, what we think of as what we've esteemed as scientists and grown-ups is, I guess it was like 3 years ago, you know, off of Australia, a scientific ship goes, we found an amazing thing, a giant octopus. We'd never seen one before. It was amazing. So we killed it.
Yeah,
I'm like, no!
Quick.
Yeah, and so, yeah, so we say to all of life, you know, whatever you find, you know, whenever you find a human, hide, God, run, you know, go back to the deep.
Yeah, aren't we great? We really have.
Well, I want to just spend a little bit more on this because, yeah, we have a wonderful ally who's a mathematician. I call him a mathematician. And he says one of the greatest losses of intimacy, and this is really kind of what you're talking about, in the modern world was when the teaching of math was divorced from the teaching of nature. And I was like, oh, yes. And you're saying also about the deep sea and the cycles and the rhythms. And so how we teach people. I also remember hearing, you know, a show on NPR, and it was about, you know, dendrites and nerve systems. And I was like, oh, boy, how wonderful. And so they said, well, here's this little, I can't remember what creature it was, and we're going to shock it. You know, because here it is all happy swimming here, and we're going to shock it, and look how it goes into trauma. And then we're going to tap it.
Oh, man.
And now we're going to just tap it without shocking it, and look, it goes into trauma. Isn't that wonderful?
I'm like, how would you like that?
Oh, bastards. You know, I mean, you could have given it, you know, an orgasm or chocolate or something. You know, why shock it? The whole, you know, we want the DH.
I'm not sure you can give those creatures orgasms, but if you
Well,
say so.
You never know. Or tickling. I do know that the creatures, you know, I know that giant rays love to be tickled. I've done this myself. They love that, and I think the purpose of humans is to give pleasure to animals. But the education model is like, you know, that level of science is teaching humans to torture, you know, in order to gain knowledge.
Yeah, of course, yeah, it is.
And so growing up to torture is no mystery there. And so you're really proposing a crucial necessity, which is how we teach that it be with wonder and information and reverence.
Yeah, because where have we gotten with all this? That's why I love when people say, well, we're doing it, we've been doing it, we've done, well, where did it get us? You know, this is not right. It's obviously not the right way to do it. And, you know, we're stuck on these old notions, and I just think, you know, I see that, I do a lot of speaking around to school groups, and I'm always sure if I do an affluent school someplace because they have the money to fly me someplace, that I get into the inner city or into the backcountry and talk to those kids. And I see the same twinkle in the eye of those kids in the inner cities and in the backwoods that I see in the more affluent schools. And in fact, I see more passion in those kids' eyes. And I really think they deserve better. That, you know, it's not always about having to test them and compare them, because I really do believe that every life on this planet is precious, and I think every life, and I think that I try to live that, And I think that that's something we could all, learning that way of life and that kind of respect is probably pretty important going forward.
Well, I think it's the key to everything that you're guiding us to, which is, informed education and wonder. I think Einstein's famous for saying some damn thing. The more we know, the more we are full of wonder and uncertainty and mystery, and that is what ignites enthusiasm. Wonder and enthusiasm are really what we want to cultivate. So at this crucial moment, where we do want to be guided, we don't want to be infantilized, we want to know the harm that is we've created, even if we only get a tiny measurement of that, in order to have there are moments in human history where there's suddenly lots of inventions and ingenuity and renaissance and music and stuff, we go, now would be really good, so that, as you say, that it's the ocean, it's the education system, it's the story, and it's also the word culture comes from what are we grow, including a petri dish, and then way down the list, it is only by analogy, what do we encourage the growth of in the human spirit or intellect?
Sure.
And so really, it's vast, and also everything that wants to change now about what are we inviting people to cultivate. And it goes back to, you saying when you were on the PBS show and John Meacham said, when was the last time Americans did the right thing? Maybe not the right question, because everybody just goes, I can't think of one. But now would be the time. The model is, whatever we speak to in others, we're inviting that part of them forth. So when you go forth into the schools or speaking as you do now or at the TEDx conferences, you're speaking to a part of humans that is very underfed and eager to respond. Yeah? I mean, so, wonder and amazement.
No, I think people are realizing that there's got to be a different way than what we're doing. And also this whole business about being driven by faster, 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 and greed, more, 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 is a bit disconcerting, because I think it's reached, I keep thinking it's got to slow down sometimes at some point, but, I'm not seeing that.
There is collapse. I mean, it's human collapse is so ungraceful. It takes so many other life forms with it that we don't, slowing way down, one of the models I like is, slowing way down in order to speed up. And this is from Janine Benyus. We were talking scientifically and metaphorically that, when we slow down, say, each one of us to dedicate, we kind of increase our signal. And she brings up this wonderful term in biology, vertical integrated hierarchy, meaning that everything contains the plan of the larger thing it's a part of.
Yeah, I believe
that. And so when we kind of slow down and dedicate, we then are more likely, in her words, to be self-assembled, to be, she says, this is what makes for nature's resilience, endurance, and self-assembling, that we might be drawn into the larger thing that we're a part of, which we yearn for,
Yeah, I think so. That's a good point. I'm a real believer of sometimes just stopping and listening. Just stop. Let the universe wash. Let the wake catch up to you, but just stop for a while and let it wash over you and absorb it. I do believe that.
So is that one of the beautiful things to which you were referring when you said you can't go from the surface of the sea to the bottom without it changing you, that it is this amazing wonder, like, whoa, and
sure,
all this complexity. And
Carolyn, I have to do tell you, though, that's an incredible privilege to go to the bottom of the sea, but you can get the same fascination by just letting standing outside at night, like we talked earlier, or going to a forest, or standing at the edge of the sea, or wherever you are. I think it was Proust that said, the true voyage of exploration is not so much in seeking new landscapes as in having new eyes. Have those new eyes. Look around you differently, think differently, feel differently, and don't just do it with your eyes, but do it with your all your senses and your heart. And I honestly believe that. And sometimes people laugh at me because I walk along the coast, the shore, a bike path on the way to my office. It's only a few miles from my home, and they see me stopping and smelling flowers all the way, saying, "I'll never going to get to work." It's important to me.
Oh, you are such a great scientist. I could have been a scientist if you'd been my teacher. This is great. If there was reverie
why not absorb life? Gee whiz, what's it about? Is it about getting to your desk, as fast as you can get there? I learn something every time I stop and do that.
No, that is so great. And also, you know, from the, you know, TEDx talk where you were presenting the TEDx oil talk, and saying again, you know, only 10% of the ocean's been explored at the bottom, you know, and more variety than tropical rainforest. I just want to repeat that, which is crucial because again, the toxic mimic of what we're, where we're still being conditioned by the mainstream news to, there's the little cartoon of the bottom, like, and it's just like little human things in a desert, you know, little constructions in a desert and robots going in. It's like, no, no, you know, again, more variety than tropical rainforest. So what is likely to be down there that we're not seeing?
Yeah.
On the cameras.
Well, I know these lakes, there are these lakes at the bottom of the Gulf, the methane lakes, brine pools. If you go to that site I talked about, I think you'll see some, the Flower Garden Banks. Two words, Flower Garden, and three words, Flower Garden Banks. There are those lakes, which are, look just like lakes on land. They have waves, they have a shoreline. But there's whole communities of life that live around those shorelines. And things called tube worms that are like flowers. They're beautiful, and they're animals. Some of them have roots that actually go into the sediments, but they're animals that look like flowers. There are crabs, clams, shrimp, all sorts of animals living in these communities around the lakes, and you know, we're wondering those are at risk. There are the corals that the corals of the deep Gulf, and we wonder about those because they not only contain a very important record of climate history for us, but they are the breeding ground, many of them, for recruitment for the larvae and other animals for the fisheries and the like. So it's the creatures of the midwater, the plankton, the zooplankton, the animals that live there too. You know, the Gulf was a very rich, as you can imagine, a very fairly rich fisheries area too. So it's all those things that happen to be right there, right where this happened to occur.
Well,
and we don't know. We can see at the shoreline, up on the surface, what's happened, but deep in the Gulf, we don't know. And the glimpses we've got have not been good.
What are the glimpses that we've gotten
just
that
we're killing things? You know, as Susan Shaw pointed out, you know, the dispersants are eating through the scales, the skin and the flesh of fish. The you know, on top of that, we've got acidity from not from the oil spill, but from climate change that's dissolving any kind of bone. You know, it's very difficult to for creatures to create their skeletons. So it's you know, it's just not a pretty picture right now deep in the ocean. There is hope, mind you. I mean, we can turn this around. Like I said, we can. The Earth can heal itself to a point. And we can learn by working with the Earth rather than, you know, it's bad to act emotionally, too.
Mm-hmm.
Not so good to run onto a beach that's covered with oil and to steam clean it right down to the microbial layer because that does longer-term damage than the oil would have done. So it does take a blend of passion to heal the Earth and the knowledge to do it in the right way.
Right, and not reactively, but, you know, informed responsibly and wondering about repercussions. The crabs, the clams, the corals that live
sure.
several miles down, how are they constructed that they can stand that pressure?
Oh, they're very smart. They don't have any sort of bladder in them that can be pressured by the ocean. So there's no air bladder to squeeze. In fact, when we go to the deep ocean, where there are many, many, many thousands and thousands of crabs, some of them will actually climb onto the frame of the submarine and come up to the surface ship with us, and they're fine. In fact, they can last for days because it's not the pressure that bothers them so much as it is the temperature changes, and then we bring them back down to the bottom again. So these animals, there's nothing to squeeze. Once you go into the bottom of the ocean with any kind of an air pocket, you're asking for trouble.
Uh-huh.
Big trouble. Yeah, so that's the trick. They've learned they've grown up in that world where they don't need to have any sort of air pockets in their body.
And they like catching the ride, apparently, on the submarine.
They're great, yeah. Out of the crabs, yeah, they do. Octopuses, too. If you search on Dave Gallo plus TED for the TED Talks, you'll see a shape-shifting, color-changing octopus. That's a very popular talk, and I think it's magical what that octopus can do with its body colors and body texture. That's the work of a guy named Roger Hanlon, but I was fortunate enough to be able to share it, and it's phenomenal what some of these creatures can do with their with their bodies.
As well as the psychic octopus in Germany who predicted all the World Cup wins.
Yeah, what about that? Yeah, that's pretty good, huh? Octopus
is,
you know.
That is pretty good. But then, of course, there were angry fans who wanted to go kill it. And I'm like, oh, humans, stop. Stop.
Get the garlic and the oil. Nothing like a little pulpo.
Right. And I think I remember from Jacques Cousteau that octopi mate for life, right?
I'm sorry, octopi.
They mate for life.
Oh, I don't know. You know, when you poke into that little bit of wisdom,
yes.
I think like with albatrosses, I found once I visited a woman on an island in the Galapagos, and she said that there was one female albatross that had about 37 different lovers.
And octopuses are the same?
I don't know.
We don't know. Okay, I just remember from a Cousteau thing. But yeah. So yes, in these waning moments here, you know, where you have the capacity to direct some, you know, ardent or great team of collective attention, you know, you can imagine some of the harm. We don't know, but we know it's catastrophic. So the Gulf, as we know it, you began at the beginning of the show to say, the Earth will go on, the ocean will forever be different. We've done that. Is the Gulf dead now? I mean, really, most life in it is that dead?
And no, I don't think so. I don't think anyone believes that. I think that we think in certain areas, in certain patches, it's going to be very bad. In other places, it will heal if we give it a chance and work with it and not try to do things that make matters worse. I don't know. I think we do want to know how bad it really is.
Yes,
and
we do.
And hopefully we learn from this that the next time this happens, we're ready for it and we can prevent it.
Next time. Everybody keeps talking about the next time. That's right. And BP is getting ready to drill in the Arctic. And we go, no. You know, So we, yes, the next time.
I know, Carolyn. But here's the question. Do we have the will? Just like that question, to change the way, in order to not have it happen again, we need to change the way we do business. We need to change our habits, the way we use energy and the way we value energy.
And learn from the extremophiles, really, you know.
Learn from the extremophiles, yeah. I mean, do we have the will to do that? And, you know, again, it's on us, and the universe is watching, so.
We have been listening to a rebroadcast of the Visionary Activist Show from July 15th, 2010. We will convene live next week with the 13th guesthood of Martine Prechtel. For more ways to play, coyotenetworknews.com or Patreon Visionary Activist Show. Woof, woof, woof.